Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, who is Mike B. from Queens, New York.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And as a result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and good sponsorship and having a home group, a loving God of my understanding has kept me sober since August 15, 2007. And for a guy like me, that is truly, truly a miracle. Because at one time in my life, I had, you know, even a hard time even just getting a few hours together at one point in my life. You know, so to have anything even more than a few days is a miracle for a guy like me. I'd like to thank you, everybody, for welcoming here. I've heard a lot of great things about this group, and a couple of your home group members have actually visited my home group, which is the Problem Solve Group in Glendale, Queens, which is in New York City. And if you guys are ever in the area, please come see us. We're a beginners meeting on a Friday night, and we'd love to welcome any of you guys. You got to bear with me. This is my first time speaking at a one-hour speaking meeting. So if I tend to go for an hour and a half, I apologize in advance. You know, please don't pull me off the podium and beat me up outside. You know, it's a big deal for a guy like me to show up somewhere like this. It really is. I was talking with my friend Tommy on the way here, and I mean, as far back as I can remember, even in grammar school, I had a hard time showing up. You know, my life was just run by fear, even from an early age. You know, we were talking about doing class projects or showing up for an oral presentation in front of a classroom. And I remember even in the third and fourth grade, I couldn't show up to do that, you know. But here I am tonight. I stand here, you know, a recovered alcoholic. And this is all because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm able to even do something like this, come here and do the best of my ability to carry a message of hope and just share my experience. You know, and even at that young age, I sensed that there was really something seriously wrong with me. My wife is a guidance counselor in a high school, and they recently handed out some paperwork for the students to fill out. And on that questionnaire, there was a question on there that asked the students, have you ever thought about hurting yourself or hurting someone else, or even thought about committing suicide? And they probably handed this questionnaire to about 2,000 students. It's one of the largest high schools in New York City. And one student came back with an answer that said something along the lines of that, yes, they did think about hurting themselves. And, you know, it was a really big deal for them. You know, they got the police involved. They contacted the parents. The parents had to come down to the school. And it was like a really big deal, you know. And I was like, wow. Like, to me, that seemed normal. Like, I had a hard time, like, believing they made such a big deal about it. Because I remember as a kid at a young age thinking about committing suicide. I had a hard time with life. I thought there was nothing wrong with thinking about killing yourself, you know. So it was very awkward for me to hear that. So like I said, I sensed even as a little kid that there was something seriously wrong with me thinking about committing suicide at a young age, because I was full of fear even at a young age. You know, I was the kid who my mother would drop me off at school the first day, you know, as early as second grade, and I was crying my eyes out because I was afraid. You know, I was afraid to meet new people. I was afraid to get my hand up and introduce myself in front of everyone and, you know, ask questions in front of the teacher, in front of all the students. I was just really, really run by fear my entire life, you know. And, you know, like I said, feeling that there's something serious wrong with me. And at a young age, the way I felt that, the way I was able to bear with that is, as you can tell, I'm not from around here, as you can probably tell from the way I speak. I grew up in a town called Williamsburg, Brooklyn, in New York City. And as a little kid, there was always something going on in the streets. I mean, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 12 midnight, there was kids outside in the street playing ball, wiffle ball, manhunt, hide and seek, whatever. And as a young kid, that's where I got my thrill from. That's how I dealt with that insanity that was going on in my head. I was able to stay out in the streets, and I was able to play ball, and, you know, I was able to mingle with the guys on the corner and have fun. And, you know, and I always strive to be the best baseball player on the corner, the best at manhunt, the best roller skater, the best hockey player. There was always that striving me to be the man in front of everybody. And that's how I really dealt with that insanity that was going in my head, you know. But, I mean, it just got to the point where I remember hitting the age around 11, 12, 13 years old. And, you know, it was around that age I started to go on a baseball team where I wasn't the best baseball player on the team anymore. My father was no longer the coach. I was outside of my comfortability zone. You know, I was playing on a hockey team with guys that were much better than me now. And my father wasn't the coach of the hockey team anymore, totally outside my comfort zone again. I go into a middle school, and I'm no longer the smartest kid in the class, and I'm not the most popular. You know, and then a few years later, I end up in high school, and I'm no longer the most popular kid in school, and I'm not the smartest guy in the school. And, man, that's really tough to deal with a guy like, for a guy like me, you know. And how do you deal with that insanity that's going on in your head full of fear, just constantly be guided and ran by fear, you know, constantly nervous and my hands constantly clammy and things going on in my head. And, you know, how do you deal like that? How do you deal with life like that? You know, and I found my solution, and that was alcohol, you know. And I got to tell you, if you ever seen the movie The Bronx Tale, that's exactly what my neighborhood was like growing up. And if you've ever seen the movie, there's a character played by Robert De Niro, and his name was Lorenzo. Lorenzo the bus driver. And Lorenzo was known as a working man, and he was a well-respected guy in the neighborhood who stood away from all the illegal activity. And that was my dad in the neighborhood. My dad was a well-respected man in the neighborhood. He was a tough man. Everybody liked my father, and he stood away from all the nonsense. And he tried his hardest for me to stay away from all the nonsense in the neighborhood. You know, I relate to Bill W. saying, you know, ominous warnings which he failed to heed. You know, my father would drive me around in his car, I remember, as a little kid. And he would point out to me guys in the neighborhood. And he'd say, you see that guy standing on the corner there? You know, it was a little bummy looking. And my father wasn't so kind back then, the words he used. He said, see, that guy's a junkie. He said, he used to be a good-looking guy. He used to be a smart man. He used to make a lot of money. He used to be hanging around with a lot of good-looking girls. Now look at him. He's going to amount to nothing in his life. You know, he's in his 50s, and, you know, look at him. He's a piece of crap, you know. And my father used to warn me about the things that I was doing. He used to say, you know, if you drink, if you get high, if you hang out with these guys in the corner that you're hanging out with and you don't listen to your father, you're going to end up in a lot of trouble and you're going to end up just like that guy, you know. And if you fast forward this thing, I ended up just like that guy that my father told me stay away from my whole life. You know, but at age 12, 13 years old, you don't see that. You can't see that far down the road, you know. I don't remember the very first time I picked up alcohol. I really don't. But I do remember the feeling that alcohol produced for me at a young age. You know, what we used to do is gather together on the corner, a whole shitload of us at 12, 13 years old, and we'd grab the guy who was 15 years old, who had a beard, and we'd send him into the corner bodega, and he'd buy a, you know, a 40 ounce of Old English or a few 40 ounces of St. Ides, and, you know, he'd get to the corner, crack that beer open, and we'd pass it around, and we were done with that one. We'd send him into the store again. And I can remember clearly the feeling produced by alcohol, and I cannot put it into words. Words does not do it justice. You know, the best I could describe it is a feeling of all that insanity that was going on in the head, all that chatter that was going on in my head was just gone. It vanished. It was no longer there. You know, I was no longer afraid of people. I was no longer afraid of people in school. I was no longer afraid to approach pretty girls or hang out with the older guys in the corner. I didn't care what anybody thought of me. You know, it was a solution to the insanity that was going on in my head, you know. And I chased that feeling for a long time, nearly to the gates of insanity and death, you know. And I know a lot of people say when they drank alcohol at that young age, their muscles got bigger and, you know, they got better looking and they became more intelligent. Not me. I don't know. I was still fairly somewhat smart. You know, I was still a skinny kid with a big nose. My muscles didn't get any bigger. You know, it didn't provide that for me. But I tell you what it did for me. It removed that insanity, that chatter that was going on in my head. And those girls that were having a house party around the corner from where we were drinking, you know, I got the guts to go into that house. And what alcohol did for me, it made me dance. Alcohol allowed me to dance. It allowed me to dance hip-hop. It allowed me to dance reggae. It allowed me to go up to that girl and ask her to kiss me. And, you know, it provided me with this feeling. And what it did for me, and almost till the end, is that it put a battery on my back, a fire up my butt, and just lit me up. You know, my sponsor says it best. It gave me this let's get up and go out of town kind of party feeling. You know, and I love that feeling. And I chased that for a long time. You know, and I would be a liar if I said I didn't have, you know, fun drinking. You know, I had a ball. We had a blast for many, many years, me and my friends. We really, really did. And I tell you, man, you know, it started hanging out in that corner and in parties, you know, house parties around the corner from where, you know, the stoop we used to drink on. And, you know, it ended up to going to city clubs in Manhattan at the age of 14 years old, hanging out with all the older guys. You know, because the older guys in the neighborhood, they love bringing the younger cute guy around with them. Wow, look how cute he is. Look at him. He's a good kid. You know, get him around. You know, they love bringing me around and spoiling me. So I hung out with the older guys. You know, they got me drunk. They provided me with my solution. They took me all over the place. So I loved it. You know, take me out to the city clubs at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we used to take these trips away for the weekend and go out and party. We'd have a ball, man. You know? And gradually I'd get older and, you know, I end up in these places and city clubs. And, you know, I'm drinking in the Copacabana and, you know, I'm in the VIP section, popping bottles of champagne and popping bottles of Jack Daniels with a bunch of pretty women around us and, you know, just having a great old time, you know, and just chasing that feeling that alcohol produced for me. You know, and I got to say, anything that really interfered with my drinking just really had to go, you know. I remember I was a valedictorian in my middle school, and I ended up getting an academic scholarship to my high school, Christ the King. And when I went there, not only did they were they happy that I was academically smart, but they seen I was athletic. Because remember, I grew up on the streets playing ball my whole life. So they wanted me to play football, and they wanted me to play baseball. They wanted me to run track. They wanted to really get me involved with athletics, you know. And they would actually come play in a football team. Come try out for track. We see your numbers during gym class. We see how you're playing sports. We really want you to be a part of our program. And I would just think, Friday nights, I'm not going to be able to go out and drink. I got to wake up Saturday morning and go to practice. Ain't happen. Sunday morning's practice means I can't drink Saturday night. Practice means hard work. Can't do that either. You know? So right away, I'm not getting involved in sports because nothing's going to get involved in my drinking, which at that time is only on the weekends. You know, nothing is going to get in the way of my solution to the insanity that's going on in my head. I got to sit in school all week filled with fear. I can't even get my hand up and ask that question because I'm afraid of what people are going to think of me. And I got to live like that my entire life. And then I can't even take care of that problem on a weekend. No way. It's not for me. Not for me. You know, and I'm one of those guys that, like in the big book says, you know, I had a bright, promising career, bright future ahead of me. And, you know, my father thought he was raising that son that that was going to listen to him and really be successful in life. And he's really going to get out of that cesspool of a neighborhood and not be like all the other guys in the neighborhood and get into trouble. You know, and he ended up having an academic scholarship to St. John's University, one of the bigger colleges in Queens, New York. And, you know, I lasted there for about a year and a half, and my deal was I'm going to school. I ain't making money. You know, I'm hustling a little bit of money on the street, but if I'm not making money, I can't drink. I can't get high on the weekends. I can't do this. So here I am, I mean, throwing away thousands and thousands of dollars of free education, and I sit down with my father, and I tell my old man, and I say, Dad, I can't do this school thing no more. I got to get a job making $400 a week. I got to support this habit, you know. And that's exactly what I did. Probably one of the saddest moments of my father's life was hearing that come out of my mouth. You know, all his hopes and high dreams for me were just smashed at that moment, you know. And, you know, if you fast forward this thing, it starts, like I said, on the corner and in the VIP section of the Copacabana. But then it starts to turn a little bit ugly, you know, because you leave school and you're making a few $100 on the weekend. I mean, during the week, and then the weekend comes, and that few $100 is gone on Sunday morning. Gone. You know, and I started to wake up with these horrendous, horrendous hangovers and started to get involved with a ton of bad shit. And I started to really, really feel bad about myself. And what I would do on these hangover mornings is that I would really think about committing suicide. You know, and this is at the age of 19 years old, and I went on like that for 7 years, thinking about committing suicide and saying I'm never, ever, ever, ever going to drink again. And I would do that every single weekend. For 7 years I was doing that. I'm never going to drink again. I can't keep a dollar in my pocket. My girlfriend can't find me for the weekend. I can't show up to work on Monday. You know, which baffles me that I'm even standing here, because my name at work used to be known as Mikey No Show. Now, if you would have looked at my foreman's phone, he had me as Mikey No Show on his phone, because I was incapable of showing up for anything, because I was just a mess, you know? And but still chasing it, because I still need that relief. My sponsor says, you know, there's three stages of alcoholism. You start off in the fun stage, then you go through the fun problem stage, and then you end up in just the problem stage. But at this time, when I left school and I'm making money, that's still the fun problem stage. And that's all right to deal with, because occasionally the odds are still good. You know, it's not like going to Vegas yet where the odds are just totally, totally against you. You know, there's like 90% chance you're going to win. Right now, the odds are still good for me. Where I'm going out occasionally and I'm still having a good time. You know what I mean? And I'm still not heeding the warnings from my old man saying, you're going to amount to nothing. You're going to be a piece of crap. You know, going to the doctor and the doctor saying, you're born with a heart condition. You keep drinking. You keep getting high. You keep doing steroids. You're going to die, kid. You know, all that is going in one ear and out the other, because I love chasing that feeling. You know, I love chasing that feeling. You know, and I end up with a really good union job. All right. And this is what started happening to me after a year of this good union job is, I'm that guy who went from high school who can't get his hand up because I'm afraid of what everybody's going to think. I'm doing the same thing at work. I really, really want to be a successful worker. I really want to be a good apprentice, and I want to be a foreman in my union one day. But I just can't do it because I'm filled with fear. You know, I'm the guy that wakes up in the morning, and I am just plagued with fear. I just can't even get out of bed. You know, whether I had a drink the night before or not, it would just keep me down. It would just rattle my brain and just paralyzed me that I couldn't even get out of bed. Getting out of bed used to baffle me, you know. What a hard time I used to just have just to put on my shoes and walk out the door, you know. It's amazing the things that used to baffle me. You know, so here I am having a hard time even showing up to work. And, you know, I'm having a hard time when I'm there and I'm really, really afraid of these people. I'm afraid to ask questions and I don't like being a low guy in the totem pole. I don't like being a gopher going for coffee. So when work is unbearable all week long, what do? You go to the bar at 3 o'clock on a Friday. You know, and that's what I did. I'd go to the bar right after work, right off the train, and I'd sit on the bar stool, and I'd say, give me a nip Budweiser and two shots of Jack and Coke. And something would happen to me. You know, it's that magic elixir that Bill W. talked about. Right? We use that. It's amazing how alcoholics describe alcohol. Magic elixir, magic potion. It does wonderful things for us. Normal people don't call it that. They don't get that battery on their back, that fire up their butt. You know, they don't feel like they could take on the world. Because all of a sudden, I go from a shy, nervous, fearful, timid kid at work or at school, and I go into that corner bar, and all of a sudden, I'm the life of the party. I'm the life of the party. I don't care about anything. You know, what's next? I get that little comfortable feeling, and I'm chasing that for the rest of the night. You know, and I would have friends who would come with me to the bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're non-alcoholic, right? And we'd order two shots of Jack and Coke each, and we'd have a nip beer each, and they would look at me and they'd say, I'm going to go home now. Maybe I'll come back out later. And I would scratch my head and say, how do you do that? And sometimes they would go home, they'd take showers, and they'd come back, they'd have a couple more beers, and they'd go home and they'd show up to work on Saturday. You know? And my would scratch my head, how the hell did they do that? Baffled me. You know, in my union job, saying yes to overtime on a Saturday, you better be there. Because if you say yes and you don't show up, you're taking a job away from a guy. You're taking away a few $100 from a guy who could be making money for his family. You know? So countless Fridays before I went to that bar, I would tell my foreman, John, I'll see you tomorrow morning. I'll be here at 7 a.m. sharp, I promise you. But I go to that bar and I have those shots and I have those nip beers with those guys and something happens to me and I can't guarantee you what's going to happen to me. But something happens to me where I just get this feeling of, what are we doing next? You know? And I'm at that bar and it hits 5 o'clock and I say, I'll stop drinking at 7 o'clock. And 7 o'clock comes around, I say, I'll stop at 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock comes around, I say, I'll stop at 11. 11 o'clock comes around, I say, stop at 1. 1 o'clock comes around, and I say, I might as well just keep going to 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'll just go straight to work. You know? And in my head, it sounds like a really, really good plan. I really think I'm going to be able to do that at 3 o'clock, stop at 5, and at 5, etc. I really think I'm able to do that. You know? But I just can't pull it off. You know, maybe one time is just a mistake. But every Friday night, I'm doing the same thing over and over and over again. I can't pull it off. And 5 o'clock in the morning comes, and I pass out, and I wake up the next day around noon, and I say, shit, I did it again. You know, and I go into work on Monday, and what happened, Mike? Where were you on Saturday? Oh, you know, I had to take care of that thing. You know, my mother was sick in the hospital, my grandmother, the dog, and this and that, and always coming up with all these excuses. Yeah, we know, we know. You're going to be there next Saturday. I promise I'll be there, John. And the same thing. You know, and I didn't know what that was. Why is it when I go into a bar at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I can't leave there till 5 in the morning? Why is that? Why can't I be like my friends? And I didn't learn until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm up against this thing called an allergy of the body, phenomenon of craving. I am physically different from my friends who could go into a bar, have a couple of drinks and put it down, who do not get that feeling that they could take on the world, and they don't get this let's get up and go out of town kind of party feeling. They might feel a little bit relaxed and get a nice little bit of a buzz in their head. They might even start to get woozy and say, that's it, that's enough. My sister has a real allergy to alcohol. She puts it in her body and she actually breaks out. And she says, I'm done. I'm feeling a little messed up here. I can't. You know, I have the other type of allergy. I have alcoholism. And when I put something in my body, I can't guarantee you what's going to happen. You know? But what's even scarier than that is this mind that I have. That before I even go to the bar, I say, I'm not going to drink tonight. And I have these voices going on in my head. Who am I kidding? I'm going to go to a bar on a Friday night and hang out with the boys. And I'm just going to go hang out and have a good time. Maybe there'll be pretty girls in there. And I'll tell you, I went to that bar for years. And there was never, ever an attractive girl in that bar. Ever. You know, if you've seen Goodfellas, those are the types of guys that I hung out with in bars. They were ugly old men with cigarettes hanging out of their mouths. And Who's on the Lam for 25 years. And, you know, Joey Pies and Frankie the Nose and Tommy Fingers and all these. There was never pretty women in there. Ever. But that's what my mind has the ability to do, is paint this pretty picture that this time you're going to have a great time, you know. And I would go there and say, I'm just going to sit in this bar and have a good time, meet some pretty girls maybe. And I'd sit at the bar and I'd have this thing going on in my head. It'd say, Mike, you can't drink tonight. If you drink, you're not going to show up to work tomorrow. And I have the other, come on, Mike, you're going to have a good time. There might be a pretty girl walking in here around 11 p.m. tonight. Mike, don't do it. You're giving up all that good money. You're taking somebody's spot. You better show up for work tomorrow. Come on, Mike. Come on. You're going to just have a few drinks, and you're going to feel really, really good tonight. You'll get over it. No big deal. You'll show up to work, no problem. Mike, don't do it. Mike, stop being a punk. Just pick it up. You know? And I throw it down, and it's all off for a guy like me. You know? And then starts the problems. The real problems in my life, you know. And what starts to happen to a guy like me is you end up in hospitals and institutions and stuff. And, you know, I'll share this experience at every meeting. I had this these big plans for 4th of July weekend. It always reminds me of it this time of year. And, you know, I went into that corner bar like I usually do right before a holiday weekend. And with these big plans of going away to Seaside Heights with my friends for the weekend. And I said, I'm just going to go have a few drinks tonight. Just get a little light, you know, level-headed, nice and easy, so I could go home, pack my clothes, and go away with the boys. And, you know, I had a few drinks at the bar. But again, I'm not worried like those guys who could just cut it off, you know, and I got to bring stuff home with me, whether it's booze or anything else. And the party continues in my house. Yeah, I love the word party, right? I'm by myself in my house alone, right? In my house, by myself alone, and I'm pounding them down, and I'm just putting them whatever in my body, whatever's there, and, you know, what are these pills? I don't care. I'll try those as long as it'll make me feel different, because I put booze in my body. It wakes up this beast in me, and whatever's around, if it's just going to keep me out of myself, I'll take it. I don't care, you know? And later on that night, I call my brother, hysterical crying. I said, Rob, I need to go to the hospital. You got to take me to the hospital. I feel like I'm dying. And he comes in the middle of the night, and he drives me to the hospital. And I get in front of the hospital and I start crying. No, please don't take me in there. I don't want to go in. And he drives me all the way back home. And I get home and I call him up on the phone and I say, Rob, I got to go back to the hospital. And he comes back and he drives me to the hospital. And I get there and they strap me in and, you know, they're taking very good care of me. And, you know, that night I had the most horrific mental, physical, emotional, spiritual bottom in my life. It was horrendous. It was really, really horrendous, the pain that I was feeling that night. And I passed out in the hospital, and I woke up the next day, and my family members are standing around the bed. And, you know, there's my father, my mother, my sister, my brother. And I come to, and my body starts locking up on me and goes into these convulsions. And I can't talk, and my jaw and my toes lock up. And I see my family just hysterical crying there. And there's my father. You know, big, tough guy from the neighborhood, and he's crying. And my brother's 6'2", and he's crying. And, you know, it's just an ugly scene. And I was in tremendous amount of pain, like I just shared. And I remember looking at these people and saying, I am never, ever, ever going to drink again. I don't want to hurt my family the way I'm hurting them. And I don't want to hurt myself the way I'm hurting myself. And the fun is long gone. I am not even enjoying myself anymore. The days of going into the Copacabana and sitting in the VIP section are gone. You know, those are long gone. I'm ending up in my basement, hanging out by myself, in my apartment by myself. And when I'm thrown out of the house, I'm ending up sleeping in somebody else's basement until they throw me out, until my brother throws me out, until the girlfriend throws me out. And I'm bouncing all over the place. The fun is long gone. You know, I'm ending up in a hotel room by myself somewhere doing crazy, absurd things. And just the insanity is going on in my life. And I'm not really enjoying myself. And so I don't really ever want to do this again. And if you hooked me up to a lie detector test in that moment, I would have passed that lie detector test with flying colors. I meant it with all my heart. I never wanted to drink or get loaded ever, ever again. You know? And it's amazing how family members believe us. I mean it this time. I mean it. That was the first time I've ever seen my father cry in my life. I've seen him cry 3 times. And all 3 times were because of me. And I said, I'm never, ever going to do that again. And I walked out of the hospital, and they wanted to take me out to eat to celebrate my recovery. And I didn't even make it to the restaurant and made a pit stop. We went out to eat, and you know, I left that dinner, and next morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, my brother sees me in bad shape sitting on my stoop. You know, guys, you know what a stoop is? Okay, Brooklyn, New York, the stairs outside a building. But anyhow, I'm standing on my stoop. And my brother comes walking by, and he sees I'm in bad shape, and he sees crazy people walking in and out of my house, and he's like, oh, my God, how do you do this to yourself? You almost died last night in the hospital. He said, are you effing crazy? And I remember thinking to myself, there's something absolutely wrong with me. I'm absolutely nuts, and I'm never, ever, ever going to be able to beat this thing. Never. You know? And the insanity just kept continuing on and on and on and on and on like that for years, you know. And eventually I hit a spot in my life where I said, you know, I just about had it. I can't show up to work. You know, I'm known as Mikey No Show, not because I don't show up on Saturdays, but because I go out for a drink on Friday and I disappear from work for 6 months. And I go back to work after 6 months and I go out for a drink after 2 weeks of being sober on a job, and I go out for a drink on Friday, and I disappear from work for 6 months. So that's why I'm known as Mikey No Show at work. I can't keep a dollar in my pocket, and the insanity is just getting worse and worse and worse in my head. You know, and I'm trying so many times, really, really trying desperately on my own to stay sober, and I got all these great plans, man. I'm going to hang out with my girlfriend. I'm going to pretend I really want to hang out with her this weekend. I'm going to take her out to dinner. I'm going to act like I really want to be there. I'm going to spend time with my sister in the Hamptons because I love my sister. And, you know, I'm going to get back in the gym, and I'm going to go tanning, and I'm going to run on the track, and I'm going to do all these great things. But what would happen to me is when I would put the drink down, the insanity would just get so loud in my head. And not only was I thinking about committing suicide on those hangover mornings, but I'm walking around stone cold sober, obsessing over suicide. How do I check out of this miserable existence? You know, I just can't get my life together. I would sit in my car outside of a park, and tears would come down my eyes, and I'd be crying. A grown man crying in my car because I want to be like those people walking in the park. I want to be able to walk my dog. I want to be able to go for a jog on a nice Sunday morning, and I just can't pull it off. Because I got this obsession of my mind, which I didn't know at the time, just kept bringing me back to a drink over and over and over again. And when I'm not drinking, I am just absolutely miserable, where it's hard for me to even get out of my bed. So I reached that point, and you know, I became willing to try something about it, and I was told by people in the union to go up to this nice rehab in upstate New York. And you know, I got to tell you, I got nothing bad to say about this rehab. Because what they did was they brought people in from Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first person I met when I walked in through the door, now I didn't know anything about rehabs. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. None of my family members were alcoholics. Nobody I knew on the streets was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know about rehabs. I thought I was going to prison. I'm telling Dad, take my watch, take my chain. First guy that looks at me wrong, I'm going to have to hit him. You know, I walk in through this door. This gentleman walks up to me and says, "How you doing? My name is Brian W." I'll never forget his name. And he says, "I'm here as a resident, but at one time I was a sober member for 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to let you know I'm here to greet you at the door. And if you need anything, you know, I got about 20 days sober and I'm leaving in a week. And I just want to let you know while I'm here, if you need anything, I'm here to help you out." And that man at that moment represented Alcoholics Anonymous for me because I didn't know anything about it. Which today is one of the reasons why I'm so adamant about having a greet at my home group. Because that was one of the biggest moments of my life, was meeting that gentleman. You know, and I went to that rehab, and, you know, they brought in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous there. And, you know, I tell you, it's funny how, you know, God gets us into Alcoholics Anonymous, because the reason why I came to AA is I seen some people come who were union electricians just like me, and they were dressed like, you know, real guineas on the street and, you know, talking like me. And I said, "Wow, man, when I get out of here, I'm going to hang out with these guys." They were absolutely insane. But I said, "I'm going to hang out with them because they're cool. I could dig Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, but I heard the message of AA while I was in there, and I started getting involved with spirituality and praying. And, you know, I heard about getting a home group and getting a sponsor and, you know, doing some service. And I came out and I tried a little bit of it. You know, I got a sponsor. And I tell you, though, at that time, I don't care if Bill W. or Bob was sponsoring me himself, I would not have been able to get sober. And for only one reason. I just wasn't done. All that suffering I did, and I just wasn't done. And my actions showed that. I might have told people when I walked out of that rehab I was surrendered and I was ready to do whatever it takes. But if you would watch my feet at that moment, it was telling you something totally different. You know, and I'm a big fan of that. If you want to know you're surrendered, watch your feet, man. Watch what you're doing. You know, don't listen to what I'm saying. Watch my feet. That's why I tell guys today that I sponsor. You know, because this could be all nonsense coming out of my mouth, you know. And, you know, I left that place and dibbed and dabbed with a little bit of service in a home group, and guys were saying things to me like, "Do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I'm like, "I'll do 4 a week." You know, if you do the math, it doesn't add up, you know. Get a service commitment. Show up an hour early to start making coffee, and I'm showing up a half hour before the meeting. You know, my sponsor's asking me to do some step work, and I'm just disappearing for a while. But I tell you what happened. When I was in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, I started to meet people who the lights were really turned on in their lives. And my first sponsor, man, the lights were on in his life. And what he would do is he'd invite me into his home. And I seen a man who had had a spiritual experience, who was on fire with this thing and talking about God. And he was a union electrician, and he was a foreman on his job. And he had a family, and he was raising a child. And I said, "Wow, man, he's a young guy like me. How is he doing that?" You know? And it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous who was doing that. You know, and that planted a seed in my mind that I met a bunch of other guys like that who were really getting their lives together. You know, who were walking around with smiles on their faces, because I wasn't smiling, man. I was an angry, angry, fearful dude. You know, if there was a smile, it was fake. You know? And I used to smile when I was drinking, too. My brother used to say I used to foam from my mouth when I was smiling, you know? But I was a very angry dude, and I couldn't imagine what it was like being happy, you know? Without booze in my system. I was so afraid. That was the one thing I was so afraid of. I'll never be happy without putting booze in my system. But I seen these guys on fire, man. You know, and something was happening to them. And those seeds were planted. And they brought me hope. Those guys really did. You know, and I'm extremely grateful to them. And needless to say, after about 3 months after being at that rehab, I relapsed. And I went back into rehab, you know, with my head down, the same place that I had just come out from. And the last time I was there, they called attendance, and they said, "Mike Bassetta." I said, "Here for the last time." And I ended back up there 2 months later. And the guys, "I remember you. Here for the last time." That was me, you know. And again, I leave that place and I go into a halfway house and I'm just not a surrendered man. And I get the results that an unsurrendered man gets. I relapse, you know. And I'm very uncomfortable in my own skin. And the alcoholism is just kicking the crap out of me, you know. And see, what happens is that I left Alcoholics Anonymous and I ended up making phone calls and telling people that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. You know, and my father, who loves me to death, and my mother loved me to death, and, you know, they're not wealthy people. They gather up some money and, you know, they find a place that's not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, and they say, we're going to send you up this place. It's not affiliated with AA. You know, it's got a good success rate. And you know, I said, you know what? I'll give it a try. Let's try this thing because AA doesn't work. You know what's funny? I go into detoxes often. Me and my buddy Shannon and Tommy came for the first time with us, and, you know, he got to experience that. And, you know, there's detox and rehabs filled with people like me who get their hands up and they say, you know what? I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't work. You know, and I ask them questions I wish somebody would ask me at that time. See, how many people were you sponsoring when you relapse? And they say none. What was your prayer meditation life like when you relapsed? Well, I was praying a little bit, you know. I was praying. All right. If it was about praying, we'd have 100% success rate, you know what I mean? How many amends did you make? Did you finish them? You know? And this is not to embarrass them. This is to raise their awareness. Because I was in that chair one day saying the same thing. It doesn't work. Did you ever do a thorough fourth step? You know? And the answer was no to all those questions, of course. You know, that was me. So I leave Alcoholics Anonymous convinced because I am so delusional. I suffer from a disease of the perception of the mind. And I really believe this thing doesn't work. And I'm going up there, and I got a lot of hope for this place, man. I'm reading some good things online about it, you know. And I go to this place, and the first night I get there, you know, it costs about 10, 15 grand. And the first night I get there, they're eating shrimps and Alaskan king crab legs. And I'm like, I am in heaven now. This is the place. How could you not recover here? You know? How could you not recover here? And there's pretty girls walking around the place. Even better. Pretty girls walking around the rehab. Well, it's not a rehab. Because here's the deal. This place doesn't believe you have a disease, so you can't be rehabilitated. They believe you have the choice of whether or not you're going to drink. And you go there and you socialize and they teach you some things and you sit in some classroom settings and they bring you out bowling and they bring you out playing softball. And I'm convinced that's really what I need. This is the answer to my problem. I'm going to leave here successful and I'm going to get my life back together, you know. But if you're there after, maybe you got some really good ambitions your first 3 weeks and I'm there after a couple of weeks and, you know, I'm suffering from alcoholism, so I start to feel very lonely. You know, so that girl over there is starting to look really, really pretty, and she'll fix me, you know, and I meet the woman of my dreams, you know, and I'm there for 3 weeks, and I say, wait a minute, I'm a smart guy, I got the power of choice of whether or not I could drink. What am I doing in this place? I'm going to save my parents $5,000, and I'm going to leave here. So that's what I do. I leave after 3 weeks, and I leave on Wednesday, I pick the girl up on Thursday, and I'm drunk with her on Friday, you know. And hence started the insanity one more time, again and again and again. And I drove my father to the point where I see my father again cry, who came to my house one afternoon, and he found something in my drawer he shouldn't have found. And my father raised his voice for me, and I picked my hands up to him, and I said, I'm not going to take your shit no more. And I wrestled him down to the ground, and my father broke down in tears. And he said, you know what? He said, I never thought I'd have to worry about you. Your brother, yeah. Your sister, yeah. But I never, ever thought it was going to be you. And basically what he was telling me is that I was breaking his heart. Because he had such a bright future planned for me. You know, he's seen his son being successful. And I turned out to be that guy in the corner that my father said to stay away from his whole life. You know. And I watched my father break out in tears again in front of me. And the second time I see my father cry. And he kills me. Because I'm a very sensitive guy, and I start to feel guilty. And when I see stuff like that, I just go on tears. You know what I mean? When my mother's on the phone with me and she's crying, please be good tonight. Please be good tonight. And knowing that I'm the source of my mother's pain and pain and misery, I can't take it. I got to go out. I got to drink. But it causes too much anxiety, too much depression in me. You know? And I ended up reaching a point in my life where after leaving that facility, I pretty much walked around for months, obsessing over drinking, getting high, or committing suicide. That's what my life pretty much looked like. And it was just getting insane. You know, it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And so what happened was, on August 15th, on 2007, I was sitting on my father's stoop in Middle Village, Queens, and I'd say that was the most painful, horrific moment of my life. I reached the point that the big book talks about, the jumping off place. I couldn't picture my life with alcohol, and I couldn't picture my life without it. I couldn't picture living with that insanity in my head without something to keep it down. And what happens is, the alcohol isn't working for me like it used to work. You know, the consequences are just way too horrendous. And so it seems like a good idea to go back inside my father's house and pull out that 9mm and just blow my brains out. What happened was, by God's grace, I had a nervous breakdown on my father's stairs. And the loving man that he is, he took me and he got me some help. He brought me into an emergency room. And it's like God sends little angels to us, man. I'm in that emergency room and I got this male nurse following me around. You know, I can't have any shoelaces or a belt on me. And he's following me around, making sure I don't hurt myself. And he said, you know, what's your problem? And I told him what was going on with me. And he said, I just want to let you in on something, kid. He said, I got 14 years sobriety. You know, if you get out of here and you go to a 12-step fellowship and you get a sponsor and you start working the steps, you know, you could be successful too. You could recover from this illness. And it's like God was planting a seed for me to remind me that when I get out of there, I could go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, from there, I end up in a psychiatric unit, and I'm sitting in the psych ward, and, you know, I'm thinking about all those guys that were trying to help me. I'm thinking about the guys that really had the lights turned on in their lives, who were really making something of their lives, you know. And I said, when I get out of this place, I want to call those gentlemen. I really want to do this thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had hit that point in my life. I had the gift of desperation. And for the first time in my life, I was fighting to get out of there, not to drink or to get high, because I wanted to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous and get a sponsor and do whatever that man asked me to do. And I came out of there a surrendered man, because if you were to watch my feet, it was doing exactly what my lips were saying. I was doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got out of that psychiatric ward and in bad shape 3 days later, and I almost ended up back in before I got to a meeting. And but what I did was, I called this gentleman who I was around in AA, and I said, I'm in bad shape. I just got out of psych ward, and, you know, can you come pick me up? And he said, I'm at a Yankees game right now. As soon as the game's over, I'll be right there. He said, go to a meeting in the meantime. And God planted another seed, because I'm at that meeting, and there's a gentleman speaking there who was talking about being sober and thinking about committing suicide. And it wasn't until he had a spiritual experience was the obsession to commit suicide and the obsession to drink lifted from him. So again, God was planting a seed for me within only just a couple of days. Within a few hours, he's planting seeds for me. You know, I get out of that meeting, and a gentleman kept his word, and he picked me up. And this gentleman was by my side. He watched me going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. He watched the alcoholic insanity go on, and he never turned his back on me. I am forever grateful for that man. And I got into the back of his car, and I was a mess. And he turned around, he looked at me, and he said, I want you to know something. There is absolutely no judgment here. Because I come from a town where people say there's winners and losers in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't believe there's any winners and losers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that there's people who do recover from this illness, but I believe that there's people who are sick, and I was one of those sick people who just was not ready to surrender and do this deal. And he said, there's absolutely no judgment here. And it meant a lot to hear that, because I thought I was a loser. Why can't I stay sober? Why can't this obsession be lifted from me? Why am I that guy at AA meetings, sitting in there on Friday nights and getting pulled out by obsessions while everybody's laughing their asses off? Why am I at an AA barbecue with 100 alcoholics and I get hit with an obsession and I can't even tell anybody in that meeting and I leave and I go? That obsession pulls me out the door, you know? And that gentleman described alcoholism for me. And I had learned exactly what I was suffering from. You know, and he asked me, he said, are you willing to go to any lengths this time? First he asked me, are you done? Are you absolutely done? And I said, Gerard, I'm done, man. And he said, are you willing to go to any lengths? And I said, whatever that means, I'm willing to do it. I don't care. You know, I'm sure you heard this. I'll stand in the corner on my head upside down naked, whatever it takes. I'm willing to do it. You know, and hence my journey began with that gentleman. You know, and he threw out a few things for me right away. You know, we didn't just sit down the next day and start reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me some easy things to do. If I wasn't willing to do them, I'm sure he wouldn't have sat down with me. He said, you know, you're willing to go to 90 meetings in 90 days? I said, absolutely. And he said, you know what? He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a tunnel to another meeting. It's a bridge back to life. But he said, your ass better be in the tunnel within your first few months as a newcomer. There's no better place to rock and roll than in the seat of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I did, you know. And I wasn't working at the time. I was on compensation vacation. And, you know, I would find meetings during the day hanging out with some crusty old men and going to the beaches with them and going out to the diner out for breakfast. And he told me make a lot of meetings. He told me make 90 meetings in 90 days. And as a surrendered man, I made well over 90 meetings. You know, on weekends, I would go 3, 4, 5 meetings a day on a Saturday, 3 or 4 on a Sunday. You know, I was desperate. I know I really needed this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed to do whatever that man asked me to do, plus more. He asked me to call him every day, and that's what I did. You know, my sponsor wasn't chasing me around. And I don't say this to be arrogant. Look at the work I did. I was beaten into that state of reasonableness. Alcohol beat me to that state. You know, I just suffered so much pain. I was just willing to do whatever he asked me to do. And I'd call him up, and he couldn't get rid of me. You know, I'd follow him around everywhere. I'd sit in his car while he was doing real estate deals, and I'd go everywhere with that gentleman. You know, and there was times I would hit serious depressions and I couldn't get out of my bed. And that gentleman would come and ring my bell and he'd pull me out into his car and say, come on, we're going to a meeting. You know, he took me under his wing. He really did. And I'm forever grateful to that man. And he told me to start fellowshipping, get to meetings early, get a home group, start doing some service commitments. And that's what I did. I got to the meetings early. I set up. I started making coffee. And, you know, I started hanging out with the guys before and after the meeting and going to the diners. And even though I felt out of place, you know, it was a lot better than doing what I was doing. Because whenever I did what I was doing, it was getting me to the same place. Back in Alcoholics Anonymous, with my hand up saying I got one day back. Over and over and over and over again. You know, and what I learned prior to that, but this guy really pounded it to me. He said, you see the meetings and the fellowship, that's just the icing on the cake. You know, he said, what you're really suffering from, you could only recover from having a spiritual experience. And the words he used is that you may be suffering from something which only a spiritual experience would conquer. And he made it up. He got that from the big book. You know? And I was convinced of that because I was trying everything else. Now, I'm the guy who goes to the therapist and I last for one visit. You know, I find a pretty girl, I buy the Lexus, I get a good job. It gives me temporary relief, but I'm putting a .38 pistol in my mouth trying to pull the trigger. You know, and I can't stay sober. That's where my mind and my thinking, my direction gets me. You know, being in a barbecue with 100 alcoholics and leaving and nobody could stop me, that shows me that I am beyond human aid. You know, and finding out that I was suffering from something which only a spiritual experience would conquer is pretty scary for a guy like me. I'm a street kid from Brooklyn. You're telling me I got to find God in order to recover from this deal? It's like being in a serious car accident and dying in hospital. And a doctor says, do you believe in miracles? The only thing that's going to save your ass right now is by having a spiritual experience. And it was like hearing that. It frightened me, you know. And I'm that guy that I think a lot of people got identify with. Maybe the spiritual experience thing worked for you, but I'm not sure it's going to work for me. I'm not sure. But maybe it'll work for me. Like I said, I've seen those guys with the lights turned on in their lives. I said, maybe this deal will work for me. You know, my journey really began with that gentleman. And that willingness to believe that a God was working in their life was all I needed to start my journey. Just to be willing that there was something out there greater than myself was all I needed to start this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if I needed to believe like my sponsor believed, or the guys I was running around with at the time believed, I would have been in a shitload of trouble. I cannot grasp their concept of God. It was just way too much for me to handle. Way too much for me to handle. Things that I grew up with and people telling me that God was going to punish me my whole life. And, you know, if I had to hold on to that God for dear life, it would have worked for me because I just didn't trust in that God. But I could trust in a God that they're believing in. You know, I could believe in a God that's personal to me, that I thought was my best friend. You know, who was kind and loving and tolerant, who was really powerful and who was a friend to me. I could believe in that. I could deal with that. And I have that little chink in the armor to say maybe that'll work for me. You know? And I stand here tonight as a sober man saying that that has worked for me. You know, and I got on my knees with my sponsor and I said the third step prayer with him. And my life started to take off because I started working the fourth step. And I experienced the biggest transformation in my entire life doing a fourth and fifth step in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was like my conception of the world. You know, maybe people experience it in 9 or even when they get to 12. I experienced it in 4 and 5 where I seen that everybody in this world wasn't against me and everybody wasn't wrong, but it was me. I was the problem. It was a sense of relief for me because I can be fixed. God can fix me, but I cannot fix everyone else. It was a sense of relief for me. And I got stuff off my chest in my fifth step that I thought was going to the grave with me, which I did a previous fifth step before in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I relapsed after. Because that promise came true, that warning came true for me that you withhold something, you're going to drink. Something along those lines. I'm not a quota. And that came true for me. I withhold certain information that was going to go to the grave for me, and I relapsed after that. But I got free of some deep down stuff with my sponsor, and he looked at me and again said, there's no judgment, and I got free. And I remember after that moment, I was able to look people in the eye. And as I was able to look at the world differently, my perception changed. You know, and I started going out and making amends to my family members whom I'd hurt. I started knocking on doors and writing letters and, you know, making phone calls and paying people visits under my sponsor's guidance. And, you know, miracles started to happen there too. You know, that guy that my brother used to sit on my chair, on my stoop, to make sure nobody would come to my house and give me everything, anything in the middle of the night. My brother asked me to be the best man in his wedding and to be the godfather of his child shortly after that. And that was mind-boggling. You know, and I said I seen my father cry 3 times in my life. And the 2 times was because of my alcoholism was destroying me and it was killing him. But my father got to watch me get married in Alcoholics Anonymous to a wonderful, wonderful woman after 2 years. And I seen my father cry for the 3rd time while he gave a speech at my wedding because he was the best man at my wedding. And he had seen what Alcoholics Anonymous had done for me. And I got to tell you, my life just started taking off. Really, really did. I no longer obsessed over drinking after a couple months of Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, I'm that guy on Friday nights getting pulled out of meetings. And I said that obsession was never, ever, ever going to go for me. And I experienced the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous where it was just lifted for me. Where God placed me in that position of neutrality. And I have never obsessed over committing suicide or drinking booze since 2 months sobriety. It's been just lifted from me, which is truly a miracle. Absolutely a miracle. And then the bonuses I got to experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I went from Mikey no-show at work, and through God's grace, I'm able to show up to work every day. And I'm given a foreman's position at work. And I'm able to watch over all the knuckleheads and watch them disappear for days at a time. And I'm able to cut them some slack because I know exactly what's going on with them. You know, how does that happen for a guy like me? How do I go from a guy who can't get out of bed and show up to work and disappear for 6 months at a time? Alcoholics Anonymous does that. Not me. You know, I just got to show up and do what's laid out by my sponsor and by the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is just a byproduct of it. You know, like I said, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result, I get to show up as a husband today. I have a beautiful 3-year-old daughter at home. And I walk home from work and she waits for me by the window and she says, Dad, Dad's home. And she jumps up and down and she runs over to me and she gives me a big hug. And, you know, she just loves me to death and I love her and I'm able to show up as a father today. Alcoholics Anonymous did that for me. You know, and I say this, you know, even though I have these wonderful things going on around me, I can never be fooled into thinking that I am like normal people. Sometimes I hold my daughter and I hug her and I squeeze her and I say she is not enough to keep me sober. I can never be so delusional to think that I am not beyond human aid and that I could be sober without tapping into a spirit. You know, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has been for me these past 5 years, just constantly growing spiritually and staying tapped into that spirit, you know. And I'll end with this. I just want to share the greatest gift that I've experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been doing this H&I work. And I had about less than a year sober, and I was sponsoring a couple of guys who were going in and out of program. But I went to this one facility with some low-bottom drunks, and I met this gentleman there, and I gave him my number, and I never heard from him for 2 months. And 2 months later, he came out, and he gave me a phone call, and we started making some meetings together. And he said, will you be my sponsor? I said, absolutely. You know, you willing to go to any lengths? And he said, I am. And I got to watch that gentleman roll up his sleeves and get busy. And after 35 years of drinking and drugging, almost on a daily basis, I got to watch that man roll up his sleeves And through God's grace, I got to watch him recover from alcoholism. I got to watch the lights get turned on in his life. And I got to, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, watch him come to his one-year anniversary with his family members attend and have his family members thank me at the meeting for helping him. And that's not me. That's only God's grace. Thanks for letting me share.